Their board tends to be people who themselves manufacture in China. They think China currency is fine the way it is. But all those little manufacturers who aren't big or savvy enough to move to China are getting clobbered by it, and they wanted the association to go in another direction. They couldn't make a decision, so they didn't. I suspect that is a lot more likely than you think. One of the things House Republicans tried to do when they took back the House for the first time in 42 years, I guess, mm-hmm. in 1995, was something called the K Street Project. You know, caution to ambitious politicians. If you're ever going to try something like that, don't give it a name that's so memorable as the K Street Project. But the idea was that they would literally go to all the lobby firms and say, you know, Democrats have been controlling this place for 42 years. It's not surprising that your main lobbyists are ex-Democratic staffers. If you don't change and start getting Republican staffers, you're not going to have access to us. And this, you know, it may not have been as blunt as that, but that was the sense. You know, you've got to start hiring Republicans if you're going to have access to us. And the argument that they made was, you've got Democrats representing you, big corporation, but Republicans are actually closer to your interests. You ought to have Republicans representing you on Capitol Hill. And that was another angle I hadn't thought about. I mean, what if the lobbyist, that is the person who's paid to lobby Congress, you know, is out of sync in some important way with the constituents that are paying the lobbyist? That happens a lot more than I thought it does. So it's a good question to which there isn't any clear good answer.
Gail Russell Chaddock with the Christian Science Monitor. This is live from the Wilson Center in Washington, C-SPAN Radio.
In front of the fellow just asked a question there in the white shirt. Your name, please.
Hi, Jason Froelich from the US Asia Institute. What I wanted to ask, well, this is really loud. what I wanted to ask was, in terms of the background of people who become congressmen and congresswomen, is it that their professional background affects how they deal with foreign policy? So, for example, I don't think that too many people ever who, let's say, had a PhD in international relations or some kind of foreign policy-related field ever would become a member of Congress. And rather, the kind of people who become congressmen a lot of times are maybe businessmen or maybe lawyers, prominent lawyers. And so, which maybe they only deal with domestic issues in their normal lives before they became part of Congress. And so how does that affect them in the, when, once they get into their careers?
Senator?
Well, I don't know what value, I don't know that there would necessarily be an extraordinary value to having someone with a PhD in foreign relations in Congress. There would be no more or less value than having someone with a PhD in economics, right? Okay, that's nice, good education, but it really depends how they can translate that knowledge into practical value, crafting legislation, understanding public policy, and understanding the impact that public policy has. I think as a
former Republican Senator John Sununu.
Of course, what we need in Congress generally are people with more practical experience working in the real economy, both domestically and internationally. So someone with business experience with a company that did importing and exporting, that was shipping product overseas or manufacturing overseas and bringing that product here, that understood the real ramifications of a number of the issues that have been mentioned, right? Intellectual property protection, the impact of the stronger versus weaker currencies and whether or not those currencies are manipulated by governments, labor relations and labor law, and the disparities we might find between labor and environmental laws, and whether or not that has a material impact in their ability to succeed here. So it's really practical experience that's missing. And in the case of the foreign policy questions that we're talking about, do they have practical experience working with, interacting with individuals, companies, and institutions around the world? I think, and is generally that is something that's missing in Congress.
David, you had a law degree and a degree in law and diplomacy from Tufts. And how relevant was that to your work on Capitol Hill? Did you find it very useful?
No. but what it was, you know, it was a demonstrated interest that I'd had for a long time, and it wasn't that it wasn't useful. It was useful, and I think that's, you know, Senator Moynihan went to Fletcher, and so he had that sort of demonstrated interest. But I think it, you know, people become interested in these issues for a variety of reasons. Chris Dodd was in the Peace Corps in Central America. That's why he, you know, embraced the Foreign Relations Committee for a number of years. And I think, just as Senator Sununu said, I think there are people from business backgrounds that are sort of interested in it from that point of view. So there are a lot of different reasons why people come to the table.
Yeah, one of the
David McKean, Woodrow Wilson Center.
Exceptions is Howard Wolpe of Michigan, who had his PhD and taught international relations in Michigan and was a specialist on Africa, came to the Congress, soon became the chair of the Africa Subcommittee, was defeated for re-election after several years in the Congress, and ended up in the State Department on their Africa desk, and then he came here at the Wilson Center, ran the Africa program, and now he's back at the State Department on the Africa desk. But So there, you could see a clear line, and he was a very, very good member of Congress, too, represented his constituents well, but eventually a Republican beat him in an election. Anything else anyone wants to add on that?
Well, since I have a PhD in political science.
You spent some time in government,
about
too.
About to declare your candidacy?
I feel I should stand up for members of my profession, not people who have economics PhDs. However, I am reminded of what William Buckley once said, that he'd rather be governed by the first 200 names in the Boston phone book than by the Harvard faculty.
James Lindsay, Council on Foreign Relations.
Though perhaps it's because he was a graduate of Yale College. I think that what Senator Sununu and what David have just said is spot on. It matters more people's practical experience, their ability to mobilize others, than knowing what it is that Hans Morgenthau wrote, or being able to do a calculation that would make the Nobel Prize Committee in Economic Sciences happy. What I do think is notable when you look at membership in the Senate and in the House is the change composition. Many more lawyers. I don't know if that's particularly to our advantage. Also, many fewer people who have served the United States military, which has often been remarked upon. A number of social scientists have explored these issues, trying to determine what difference it makes in terms of what Congress actually does. And there's no clear evidence that it does much of anything, and that what members do is constrained or driven by lots of other factors that are more important, like your party, your constituency, the events of the day, and what have you.
Thank you. Something else that William Buckley said, you remember he ran for mayor of New York City, and somebody asked, if you're elected mayor, what's the first thing you're going to do? And he said, demand a recount. That has nothing to do with foreign policy. Let's go to the gentleman here. And then I'll get you on this side.
Hi, Ryan Jacobs. I'm an intern on the House Armed Services Committee. And on a side note, I will say that I do actually want to serve on a committee one day and actually do effective work. So hopefully that happens. My question, though, veers into the lobbying stuff that we were talking about earlier. I think we kind of skirted off the topic. And there is always that kind of argument within foreign policy area that there is a certain Israeli lobby, that there is an influence on U.S. policy towards Israel, and that it's developing, and that's always, and it's maintaining a relationship. That is perhaps a good relationship, but I would like to ask if we could expand on that dynamic, if members on the, you know, panel could expand on the dynamic between the lobbies, you know, even though there are divergent lobbying interests within the Israeli lobby. And my second question, sorry if I'm taking too much time, is just in regards to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Serving on the Armed Services Committee, I find that there's a lot of, it's the House on, you know, the House Foreign Affairs Committee. They don't really get any money. They don't appropriate as much. Is it important to have that support base? So for the Armed Services Committee, they have a defense industry support base. Now, where is that support base for the Foreign Affairs Committee? And if there isn't one, how do you develop one? Because, of course, the Foreign Affairs Committee does important work that needs to be recognized. Thank you.
Any brief comments on either of those questions?
Well, I've actually visited with some people recently that ask almost those precise terms, the second question, which is there any constituency for foreign assistance, foreign policy? How do you go about, would you go about organizing one here in the United States? And there's simply no two ways about it. You run up against the wall that the public at large, when asked about issues or priorities that they have for their representatives, put foreign policy and economic assistance way down on the list. So there are just natural hurdles and challenges. With regard to AIPAC, which is one of the...
Tell what that stands for.
The American-Israel Political Action Committee, which lobbies on issues that they feel are important to Israel and the greater Middle East. They've been around longer, they're better organized, bigger membership, and sort of by definition that means they're likely to be a more effective lobby, certainly one that's better known with members. And it goes to everything from local organizing locally in grassroots and having people at the local congressional level or state level and build relationships with the member, reach out to them on a regular basis, whether they're asking for legislation or not, all the way to the national organization efforts, which, involve board meetings in Washington and big public affairs conferences and the like. So to the extent that they're effective, it has a lot to do with their size, history, and scope. To the extent that their success could be replicated by other groups, I think the answer is almost certainly yes, because there are many different constituencies and groups in the country that, and as you point out, many different groups even within those that are focused on foreign policy related to the Middle East and Israel that have divergent viewpoints. So there's certainly a lot of opportunity for shared perspective.
We have time for one more question. And Francis, did you have anything I wanted to ask our co-host, first of all? If not, let's give the microphone to the gentleman next to her, Jeff Biggs.
Live discussion from the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much, and Francis, for a wonderful topic and a superb panel. One area of the world did not come up in this, which I was surprised about, and that is the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which seems to reflect a lot of what was said, because there have been some dramatic changes that have been taking place. For a number of years, we could rely upon Egypt and Turkey to play a supportive role in negotiation between the two parties. And now, in fact, Congress is thinking about eliminating entirely any assistance to the Palestinians, and in the process, seemingly to give up the U.S. role of being an honest broker. Now, I don't know what replaces that role, but would you guess that this is a result of politics or well-thought-out foreign policy?
That's above my pay grade. Anybody here?
There is a very interesting piece in CQ Weekly on this exact issue.
Gail Russell, Chaddock, Christian Science Monitor.
Detailed. There was a spike of interest in AIPAC after a book by two Harvard professors, basically saying this was the most powerful lobby in the United States. I don't know if they said on Earth, but I think they could have. Very strong book. And for a while, AIPAC kind of really disappeared in terms of other groups popped up, kind of replacing them for a time. I mean, they were still obviously there, but they deliberately took a less strong profile and in a funny way were replaced by Eric Cantor, the first Jewish Republican in the House, not ever, but, in the current House, who did some extraordinary things. I mean, just before... after the election, meeting with Netanyahu, the first time an opposition member had met with, a head of state like that, and it's shaping up as a very important issue in the 2012 election. It's a wedge issue. You could potentially drive a wedge through a strong Democratic constituency by, in effect, saying, I am more pro-Israel than you are. And that, I think it has enormous implications. You've already seen the president back off. If you compare what he's saying now with what he said in his Cairo speech, there's a striking difference. And how did that happen? And was that a process of learning on his part, or was it running up against very strong opposition, both from AIPAC, but also from a Republican House Republican group that led by Eric Cantor that is taking a role that hadn't been taken before on that issue. Much, much stronger. It's going to be interesting to see, but I predict that this will emerge as an important factor in the 2012 election, and it's giving the president a lot of difficulty because what he said in Cairo is on record. And having to kind of link that with what he's now saying risks the problem that Senator Kerry ran into of appearing to flip-flop or give up on commitments you initially ran on and made.
Senator Sununu, I'll let you have the last word, and then we can take this conversation across the hall to a reception in our boardroom.
Well, one observation about some of the issues raised, and it underscores the suggestion I made, which is you want to cultivate members of Congress who and encourage members of Congress to understand these issues related to foreign policy during the quiet times, because you never know when they're going to be needed. And we've seen uprisings and transition in power in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, other places in the Arab world through the Arab Spring. And you know, it's good that members of Congress, I think, are paying more attention to these areas, thinking about what are the national security ramifications for the United States, what are our national interests, should our perspective be on encouraging this process. But at the same time, I would want the members of Congress who are going to be leading that debate to have been thinking about, listening, understanding the culture, the politics, the economics in Northern Africa, in the Middle East, 2, 3, 5, and 10 years ago. You know, you don't want them to suddenly come to the issue and need a crash course and a crash education. So that's exactly, and 2, 5, and 10 years ago, there probably weren't many people that would say, well, gee, you know, I think you're going to have the mass protests in Egypt and a transition. I was in Egypt about a year before the protests and the transition, and talked to quite a number of real business people, not necessarily political people, about how they felt about the economy and the politics and the process, and even they didn't really see it coming. So I think there's a lot to be said for, if nothing else, you're not necessarily going to make it a huge political winner. You're not going to develop grassroots constituencies at home for getting involved in foreign policy, but you can help create opportunities for members to think and talk and discuss these issues here domestically in a way that enriches them, enriches their thinking, develops understanding and a knowledge base so that it can put to good use during turbulent and critical times.
Thank you very much. Join me in thanking our panel. And please join us for a reception across the hall in our boardroom. Thank you for coming.
This has been a live conversation at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in Washington, D.C., talking about the congressional influence on U.S. foreign policy. The panelists included former U.S. Senator John Sununu from New Hampshire, a Republican, served from 2003 to 2009 and is now an advisor with Akin Gump's law firm. James Lindsay, Senior Vice President with the Council on Foreign Relations, was there. Also, Gail Russell Chaddock, a staff writer with the Christian Science Monitor, and David McKean, a public policy scholar with the Woodrow Wilson Center. And the moderator, Don Wolfensberger, who is now the Congress Project Director at the Woodrow Wilson Center. But in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, he served on the House Rules Committee staff, including a couple of years as Chief of Staff. This program, like all the programs covered on the C-SPAN networks, will be available on our website, our video libraries at cspan.org. C-SPAN Radio is WCSP-FM Washington, around the country on XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Coming up in a minute, Washington Today, but first a note about some weekend programming.
On November 7th, the U.S.